I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Top officials in Pennsylvania and New Jersey are going to court to try to stop a Texas gun rights group from releasing design plans, allowing anyone to make an untraceable homemade gun on a 3D printer. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, it comes after the Trump administration cleared the way for its mass release.
There's this guy in Texas who's used to controversy. His name is Cody Wilson. He's a self-described crypto anarchist. And he runs a website that's providing blueprints for making a functional gun with a 3D printer.
He's the kind of person who takes a good idea, like free speech, and then he runs with it. And he runs with it so far that it starts to make people nervous.
NPR's Noel King profiled Wilson earlier this year.
He really likes shocking people. And his main idea is freedom. Every decision in Cody's life comes down to, does this make me more free?
But to top law enforcement officials in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and six other states, they say letting just anyone with an internet connection and a 3D printer become a gun maker is alarming. Anyone of any age can do it. There's no background check. The guns have no serial numbers. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro said, quote, "Once these untraceable guns are on our streets and in our schools, we can never get them back." Cody Wilson wasn't available for an interview, but his lawyer, Josh Blackman, says state lawmakers can pass gun control laws, but they're just simply providing people with blueprints. They're not giving guns away.
What they can't do, they don't have the power to, is shut down speech of citizens in other states and shut down the commerce of citizens in other states.
After a lengthy legal battle started under President Obama, Wilson's nonprofit, Defense Distributed, reached a settlement with Trump officials, allowing it to release the 3D printing directions. Blackman says the guns can be used in many ways.
These files have lots of uses. They've been displayed in museums. They've been studied in academic institutions. There's lots of value to speech, not only for actually manufacturing the guns, and the government can't censor it.
Pennsylvania officials say 1,000 people around the country have downloaded an early release of the design schematics for an AR-15 assault rifle. Unless a judge blocks it, a wider release is expected later this week. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
The heartbreak of raising a black daughter in a red state is the title of a July 21st New York Times op-ed piece penned by Shanita Hubbard, adjunct professor of criminal justice at Northampton Community College in Pennsylvania. She joins me now on Newsworks Tonight. Professor, thanks for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
From the article, we learned that you have a front row view of the way the current political climate is affecting young children. So, how is the current political climate affecting young children, and specifically your daughter?
It's a very divisive and difficult political climate. And for us grown-ups, we're still making sense of a lot of things, but just like we're having somewhat of a difficult time or some questions or some struggles with these things, so are our children, right? And it's being filtered through like an 8-year-old mind. So what's coming out isn't necessarily the most helpful for members of marginalized communities.
What are some examples specific to your daughter?
She's come home and asked me one day, "Are Mexicans rapists?" I was like, "Wow, what are you, where did you get that from?" So she's telling me something that I'll just call him little Joey in her class. Because Joey said, and she's repeating that the Mexicans that, you know, we need to build this wall because the Mexicans are rapists. And so I had to have this really complicated, uncomfortable, angry conversation with her. And she's asked me very specific things about politics that's kind of just really blew my mind.
Though you note that racism and prejudice long precedes this administration, describe what you refer to as the Trump effect.
Okay, let's be clear that racism didn't just start when Mr. Trump became in office. It's deeply rooted and embedded in the history of this country, if we're being honest. But there's something that's happening now where people feel more emboldened to say really racist things, more emboldened to not to say inappropriate things. And I imagine that this is so if you have a president that is literally saying racist things, and most times it kind of goes unchecked.
Your daughter is 8 years old?
Yes.
And have you had with her what you refer to as the talk?
I had no choice but to have the talk with her. I never envisioned having it at 8 years old, but she came home and there were friends who she had no issues with before, and she told me that they were not allowed to play with her because she's brown. So, of course, she didn't understand that, didn't know how to process that. I'm a firm believer in just having all friends. Be kind to whoever treats you well. I don't care what they look like. I don't care what cone they come from. So this is really a new concept for her to not associate with a child because they look different from her. So she didn't know what to make of that. So I had to be very candid and honest with her about that. One, I didn't want her to think it was her responsibility to try to convert the little boy in her class. Like, you don't have to be the exceptional black person so that this person can like you. That's on him. His parents raised him that like that, and we don't agree with that. So I had to have a very difficult conversation with her at 8 years old, and I wasn't expecting to have it.
You challenge white parents who try to raise their children to respect people from different backgrounds to have a carefully guided conversation with them as well. What form would that conversation take?
I don't know how that would look for white parents, but I know that it's necessary. I think white parents who are deliberate about not raising racist children, I'm not raising children who are bigoted, I want to raise children that legitimately just accept human beings for who they are. They have to be deliberate to have those conversations because it's happening around them. So what's happening is they're going to form these life views without their parents' guidance. So you have to be very deliberate and intentional and be uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable with it. So you have to step outside of your zone and just dive right in.
Do you have cause for optimism that, say, a post-Trump administration that doesn't offer the same sort of dog whistle will restore some sense of how it was prior to Trump?
I don't think it's going to happen as soon as Trump is out of office. I think we have a lot of work to do, and a lot of this is a byproduct of ignoring how much work we had to do before. When Obama was in office, there were so many people declaring that we were in a post-racial America when the statistics didn't necessarily reflect that. You still had innocent, unarmed black men and women being shot by the police and then receiving no accountability happening under President Obama. It kind of speaks to how much work we have to do as a country, as a people, because America was racist under Obama, America was racist under Clinton, America has been racist, and I think things are just coming to the surface and becoming more open. So we have a lot of conversation to have, a lot of work to do. Am I optimistic that this is going to happen? It depends on the people, not necessarily, you know, who's in office. It also depends a lot on the people. It depends on us.
Shanita Hubbard, thanks so much for expanding on your op-ed piece in the New York Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
Shanita Hubbard is adjunct professor of criminal justice at Northampton Community College and author of an op-ed piece entitled The Heartbreak of Raising a Black Daughter in a Red State. In Pennsylvania, 11,000 oil and gas wells have been drilled since the fracking boom came to the state a decade ago. Many of these wells are in farms and fields where Native American and colonial artifacts are buried. But a loophole in state law lets companies drill at these sites anyway without first considering their impact on the state's archaeology. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
On her family's ridgetop in Washington County, Karen LeBlanc edges her SUV down a newly built dirt road.
This used to be all flat field here. That used to be the view that we had. What we just drove through was a long line of Osage orange trees.
Those trees are gone, and in their place, a construction site, backed up by a big pile of dirt, really a small hill created by bulldozers. This is the land LeBlanc grew up on. This Christmas will mark 100 years since her family has lived here. EQT is developing a well site on a neighboring property, up to 16 shale gas wells extending thousands of feet underground. To access it, EQT built a road through her mother's field.
Their road will go down this way, and over on the other hill is the well pad.
To keep enough water on hand to frack the wells, the company planned to build an impoundment or artificial pond right here. But that would put it right next to her mother's house. Her mother is 81 and recently underwent chemotherapy, so LeBlanc wants the company to move the impoundment away from her house. She doesn't think the lease her mother signed 11 years ago gives EQT the right to construct all of this on her property, but the company disagrees. The two sides are fighting over the surface agreement. One prong of LeBlanc's fight is what lies beneath the ground where the impoundment would go. About 80 years ago, so the story goes, her uncle made a discovery there.
He was out exploring, actually plowing for corn in the field, and the plow struck the skull of the Indian bones. They dug it up. They saw what it was. It was viewed by several people.
Her uncle dug up the bones, but eventually reburied them, she says, to prevent looting. In 1981, the state placed the farm on its archaeological survey, a running list of potentially significant sites. But because of a loophole in state law, EQT wasn't required to check that list before it started work. LeBlanc is worried that if it digs up the field, EQT could be destroying a piece of Washington County's past. This bothers her for two reasons. Number one, it turns out one of her ancestors was Cherokee Indian. And the second reason is simple humanity, she says.
If this is your final resting place, why do we need to disturb you? You were there first. You have your right to remain there. They came after. They can move.
To press her argument that the land should be preserved, LeBlanc has enlisted help from local archaeologists. John Nass of California University of Pennsylvania is the archaeologist supervising the dig. He says this is a Native American site that likely dates back hundreds of years.
And this is what we call late prehistoric. So it dates, it postdates 1000 AD. The people who lived here, we don't know what they called themselves. Archaeologists call them the Monongahela tradition.
The site could have been a village or have religious significance. It's unclear. Cassandra Cappy is one of a group of West Virginia University students here today. After sifting through dirt on a screen, she pulls out her cell phone and flips through pictures of objects the team has found in the past few weeks. These include an arrowhead and tools made of stone.
This is prehistoric pottery. It has the marks in it from where they would put like twine or leaves to make the marks. And then on the other side is dark black, so we know it was cooked.
In an email, a spokeswoman for EQT said that in response to LeBlanc's, quote, credible claim that the site held human remains, the company hired an archaeologist to survey the field and put a hold on construction there. That evaluation is ongoing, and when it's over, the state will review it and make recommendations about how to mitigate or offset any damage the project would do. But even if the site has a big archaeological significance, nothing in state law prevents EQT from basically doing what it wants here, says John Nass.
For a private property, there's nothing we can really do about it. If you bought property that had a site on it, technically it belongs to you. Even if it's recorded with the state, you could bulldoze it away if you wanted to.
The reason is that the strength of the state's historic preservation laws really varies on what you're building. If your project is getting federal permits or grants, say a highway or a pipeline, then your project needs to get some type of archaeological review. In theory, the same is true for projects that require a state permit, like oil and gas wells. But here's the thing. Pennsylvania has a loophole called the 10-acre exemption. If a project is under 10 acres in size, no review is needed. And the vast majority of shale gas wells are under 10 acres in size. That means companies, as is the case with EQT, don't even need to check to see if their well pad is already listed on the state's Register of Historic Sites.
In that instance, even known sites could very well be destroyed or affected.
Ben Ford is an archaeology professor at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. He says one 2012 study found that in Washington County alone, 60 known sites were damaged or destroyed by gas drilling. Ford thinks state law is allowing the needless destruction of Pennsylvania's cultural and historic heritage. He'd like to see these laws get stronger. Doing away with the 10-acre exemption would be a good start.
What we're usually striving for is to gather enough information and data and know about people in the past while still having construction happen and development happen. So we're trying to strike that balance. And at least in my opinion, the current Pennsylvania state law has disrupted that balance.
If the balance is not tipped back, he says, we could be losing our ability to understand thousands of years of Pennsylvania's past. Reed Frazier, State Impact Pennsylvania.
All's Well That Ends Well is the final offering of this summer's Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival on the campus of DeSales University. Unlike the festival's other productions, this one is as close as we know to the way Shakespeare's actors would have staged it. Howard Shapiro explains in this review for WHYY.
In Shakespeare's day, no one heard of a director. You want to move somewhere on stage? You figure it out. The idea of a costume designer would have been preposterous. No one yet thought of lighting, sound, and scenery designers. Nowadays, it takes a creative village to raise a curtain. But at the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival, 15 brave actors are reaching back four centuries to Shakespeare's time. They're doing a playful All's Well That Ends Well, the way they would have done it back then. No directors, no designers, not even the standard three-plus weeks of rehearsal. The actors had 4 days to get it together, as in Shakespeare's time. They rummaged through the festival's storage rooms to find appropriate costumes that sort of fit. They chose weaponry from whatever was around the prop shop, figured out basic lighting among themselves, and found a single sound enhancement they'd use repeatedly between scenes. Yeah, that's the one. Academics call this sort of staging original practice Shakespeare, and the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival uses marketing verve to call it extreme Shakespeare. The festival has been producing one of its plays a summer in this manner for 8 seasons. I've seen most of them and been impressed. Maybe it's adrenaline that pushes the cast, but I think it's more. These actors are consummate professionals who can see through bad ideas and seize quickly on good ones, or at least it seems that way. The cast makes use of a set designed for another production earlier this summer and includes several actors who've gamely done Shakespeare this way before. Veteran Philadelphia actor Greg Wood forcefully plays the King of France, a dying man saved by a potion given him by a young woman, portrayed by Emily Kaiser. Like a genie, the revived king grants her any wish, and she wishes that a countess's son be her husband. He's played by Spencer Plachey, and he's having nothing to do with this woman who demands his troth, even though his mother, played by the elegant Susan Riley Stevens, wants to see the marriage work. All's Well That Ends Well becomes more absurd as it moves along, yet the production strikes an even tone, neither overthought nor under-focused. If you didn't know how it was produced, you'd probably not be able to guess. That's the highest compliment for an original practice Shakespeare production, not to be able to tell it from one with weeks of polish and a team of offstage specialists. The show runs at the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival at DeSales University through August 5th. I'm Howard Shapiro for WHYY.
Scratch the surface of Mars and you may encounter a large lake of salt water. Let's dive in with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, liquid water?
And it'll be chilly, too. Yes, this is a large reservoir of water, approximately 12 miles wide, but maybe only as little as 3 feet deep, 1 mile beneath the south polar cap of Mars.
Oh, so that's a lot of scratching to get
down
to.
It is a lot of scratching, yes. And again, it'll be very cold and the pressure will be very high down there. But this certainly is an intriguing finding, at least to be able to identify, finally, a true reservoir of liquid water. So this is one of the steps along the way to identifying the correct environments at Mars where life might have been conducive, that this reservoir has been found, is not to say that, aha, we've now found the location where life will be identified. That's not the point at all. This is simply a step along the way in identifying that correct environment. After all, we're talking about a place where this liquid water is, again, a mile below the surface under great pressure and is very, very briny.
We'll add Mars, then, to the list of neighbors in our solar system that do have water, principally the moons around Jupiter and Saturn.
Again, what's most intriguing to me is that this now firmly places Mars, along with all of the other bodies of the solar system, where we now know that there is or has been water. So Earth is the obvious one. The other sort of counterintuitive one, of course, is the moon, where we've been able to identify quantities of frozen water in deep craters that are at the shaded portions of the planet near the poles that don't receive very much sunlight. But it's those moons of Jupiter and Saturn where we now talk about these frozen ice crusts underneath of which are liquid water oceans several miles deep. So that really does indicate that there have been and there could be still environments that are conducive, places where life could have developed at some point.
Devoid of photosynthesis.
Well, there is that, yes. We know that here on this planet, there are environments down at ocean floors, 35, 36,000 feet down, dark, cold, under great pressure, where we find very interesting and diverse life forms. So those locations on Earth are not really very much different from those locations at those moons so far out in our solar system.
You mentioned the moon. When Neil Armstrong first set foot, and actually for the duration of the Apollo program, was it known then that there was some water on the moon?
We were not aware that there was water on the moon at that time. These are new developments that have only come about because we've sent orbiting spacecraft to do very, very close surveys of the moon. If you look back on the lunar missions in which astronauts walked around on the surface of the moon, while they went to six different places, they actually covered an incredibly tiny percentage of the moon's surface. So, for all intents and purposes, by the time the Apollo missions were over in 1972, we still knew virtually nothing about the moon, really. But since then, having put several orbiters around the moon with very good detectors and cameras, we've been able to determine far more than we ever had been able to determine by sending astronauts to the moon.
Derek, in our time remaining, what's available to be seen in the night sky this week?
We have to talk about the planets that we're seeing in the evening sky. I've been pushing this all summer long. However, time marches on. Venus itself is dropping lower and lower toward the western horizon after sunset. We don't have all that much long left to catch it along with the three other planets. So it's your first opportunity. When sunset comes, about 30 minutes later, far over on the western side, you'll find brilliant Venus. A little bit back to your left, towards the south, you'll catch the largest planet of the solar system, Jupiter. A little creamier in color, not quite as bright as Venus, but easy to identify nonetheless. Followed by Saturn, a little bit further to the south and to the east. And last, but certainly not least, way over on the eastern horizon at about 11 p.m., is the reddish planet Mars. And tomorrow, it comes to its closest approach to Earth over the last 2 years.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.